VintageRadioNetwork.com. But you knew that because you found us through the genius of the internet. Yes, it's Wednesday night. Usually at 7 p.m. Eastern. We're a little late tonight because it's a tech serve evening, and we had a few technical difficulties, and we've overcome them. Yes, I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host, and we are Burning Down the House, your weekly fix on design, architecture, and the creative arts. Brought to you this evening by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer, iPads, iPods, iMacs. Also, they have a pro audio department. Very nice. On West 23rd Street, near 6th Avenue in Manhattan, New York, New York. Thank you, TechServe. This evening, we're going to talk about memorials, monuments, built reminders of things, people, and events that we erect in our built landscape. We have Jessica Jamraz, who is an award-winning and successful competition winner, who has created a couple of different memorials, one of which is being erected in Liberty Park in New Jersey to commemorate the events of September 11th, 2001. Also, this evening in studio, we have not one, but two Vox Populi, voice of the people. Introduce yourselves, please.
Caroline Bailey of RetiringByDesign.com.
Thank you. And?
Gregory Gilderman, senior editor at TheDailyBeast.com.
Super. Well, you represent the people on the street, and so over here on the left-hand side, if we design people get, you know, off the track and you don't understand what we're talking about, it's your job to pipe in and say, but wait a second, what did you mean by that?
All right.
So this is not like Charlie Rose, you have to understand. This is a conversation among people who are interested in these things or not interested.
You know,
And it's an opportunity for our 50,000 listeners a week to eavesdrop on the kinds of conversations that go on amongst and between people who are involved in creating the built environment. Now, the whole institution of building a memorial or a monument, you know, it's age old. Someone dies, we pile up stones over their body, we create a midden. We might put some sacred symbols to remind us that that person's soul goes on to the next world, whatever that might be. And this is an age-old human urge. And I think, to a great degree, those of us who are architects take it as a sort of a cultural given, as a received notion of what is a monument? What is a memorial? We don't think this doesn't come into our play all that often. It's my feeling, and we're going to just take a brief musical break just to set up the maudlin tone for our first few little bits of discussion. Let's just roll a little bit of Barbra Streisand.
Pictures of the smile.
we left behind. Smiles we gave to one another for the way we were.
Like a joke that this should be played at weddings.
Oh my God, everybody!
Because it's so crying.
Yes, well, a lot of memorials have that maudlin sort of undercurrent. I mean, the 9/11 memorial at Ground Zero with the waterfall. You know, that is so trite near the Veil of Tears. I think they could have done something better. But now, you've done two 9/11 memorials.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's the beam here for Liberty Park, and then there's this it's almost like a maypole. You
oh,
know?
My goodness, Curtis.
Where really? I mean, it could be a very festive sort of maypole sort of thing of all these different strands of life twisting together and in a dance.
Yeah, it's so the Westchester County 9/11 memorial was for 109 people that died from Westchester County.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those strands represents one of those people who died. At the base of the memorial is a kind of tombstone or a gravestone marking each person's name and a quote from their families.
What's a website where our listeners can find images of this?
www.schwartzarch.com.
Okay.
And Fred Schwartz actually designed this memorial.
This one?
Yeah.
Okay. This is not yours.
No, I just helped
But this two parallel walls that
yes.
focus your attention on the original site of the World Trade yeah. Center, that's your design.
Yes, right.
Now, how did this come about?
Well, I was working in another office, and at nighttime was moonlighting at Fred Schwartz's office, and Fred and I designed this memorial and submitted it to the state of New Jersey.
How many people were in the competition?
There was 320 entries from around the world.
Wow.
Yeah, it was first juried by a professional jury and then juried by a family jury. And, you know, it was unanimously selected by both juries to
Super.
Win. Yeah.
So the whole institution of making a monument as opposed to a memorial, as opposed to just simply some sort of artifact in the landscape to draw our attention to remembering.
Right.
It's a slippery thing. What are your feelings about?
Well, I mean, for
these distinctions?
For instance, these two memorials are very different, and they're different from each other. The only kind of unifying factor, I think, is that they're both done in stainless steel.
And they both speak to the same event.
And they both speak to the same event, correct?
Yeah.
Westchester is a more independent kind of stands alone from 9/11, but speaks about the people that were lost from that county. Uh-huh. And the New Jersey 9/11 Memorial actually ties back in to Ground Zero and in different kind of perspectives. You symbolically are looking at the memorial in the skyline of New York where the two Twin Towers used to stand, and you're also kind of reading the name. So there's a connectivity between New York and New Jersey and the victims that were lost there.
Sure.
Well, so it's very site-specific.
But what I find really interesting about this particular, I hate to use the word, party, mm-hmm. It's near and it's far. It operates on a very grand scale across distance, mm-hmm. even though it's site-specific on the New Jersey side. We've got the Upper Bay in between, and it's like a telescope.
Yes.
So it's interactive to a certain degree that we don't often experience in a memorial. Which
That's
usually
true.
Memorials are rather static.
It's a site-specific memorial in that the two Twin Towers were icons for Manhattan.
Sure. Yeah.
Wherever you were, they stood and represented symbolically something to the city, strength and the economy. And so when those towers were attacked, and now they're gone, and now they're removed from the skyline, this memorial and its location is trying to replace them symbolically in that skyline. And, you know, for me, there's always been, you know, two memorials, right? The memorial at Ground Zero, which represents, you know, the loss from everyone in the nation. And because I've been working with the state of New Jersey, the state of New Jersey and its, you know, state has lost the second most amount of people on 9/11.
Yeah.
And so this is about connecting this memorial back to Ground Zero, mm-hmm. and kind of symbolically talking about the proportions of the tree towers and, you know, driving a visual line back to the city.
That's all well and good, but it's to understand all of that,
right,
is easy for us now because we lived through these days,
right,
and that was a very powerful a collective emotional experience. And but I'm wondering, and we could speculate about,
yeah,
this going forward, say 100 years from now, when there is a different structure there. The duality of the two walls relating to the former two towers, mm-hmm. with a view towards where the site had been. I just throw it out. I'm thinking that perhaps there will be a different experience of this memorial.
Yeah. Well, first, let's talk about the reason for memorials and 9/11 memorials and the multiplicity of 9/11 memorials.
Sure.
I think that, you know, 9/11 in particular, you know, there's so many, and usually the question is why one in New Jersey and why one in Staten Island and why one in Westchester and why so many memorials?
Sure.
And I think because of the event itself and the kind of need, I mean, these people don't have families or bodies or parts or gravestones or places to go where they can remember the people that they lost.
That's true.
And so these places are a kind of permanent monument to those people and the memories of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think very specifically these memorials are different and they kind of reinforce a place of home, a place of remembrance, a way to unify that community and strengthen and look forward, reflect upon 9/11 and come together as a kind of community to remember loss and to and to look towards the future.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me. If we look back at history, during the the golden era of the Greeks, you know, with their different wars, the the men who died in battle were cremated, but then back in their home city-state, a cenotaph would be erected. Since there was no body to have a grave site to give your respects, instead they would have... So to a certain degree, this is a cenotaph for these sub-communities of the souls who perished in this event. And so I'm just wondering...
But I think the question is you know, every memorial or every monument is different. And then it's a question of how is this particular memorial or monument designed?
Sure.
And what...
Well, this is a very specific, site-specific design, because your view is across the waters to over there. We were from here, but we died over there.
I feel like I can kind of answer what you were asking about.
Yeah, what do you think in the future is going to be the experience of this?
So
will people
say
get
looking,
it?
You're looking down and where now you can imagine the towers, and then it's going to be some crazy design with, you know, Mickey Mouse on it or whatever they're doing. It's going to, looking at those two bars are going to help you imagine what was there. Just because they didn't see or weren't alive when the towers stood doesn't mean that they can't imagine what they look like. And my father took me to D.C. For the Vietnam Memorial, and he fought in Vietnam, and the names on the wall. Nothing stood out to me, but it was still powerful to me because it was powerful to him. And if you go to the Eternal Flame, it's the same thing. It's like, I wasn't alive when JFK was president, but it still is something that stood out to me. So it's going to be there, and it's going to help people see, imagine what it was like to be there. So
I also think that there's, I mean, the memorial at Ground Zero is located at the footprints of where the Trade Towers used to be. So there's not going to be anything at that location that's built up.
Right.
There's not a lot of land area to build tall buildings in Lower Manhattan, as I...
Not that tall anymore.
Yeah. So I think that the symbology of the end walls from the perspective in New Jersey is safe, more or less. And that there's not going to be any very tall Mickey Mouse kind of structure that's going to...
No, right. But...
There isn't? There's no Mickey Mouse?
Well, I was just making that up. That's what I want.
Yeah, but by...
I'm projecting.
That's a little misleading.
But by 2110... Disney may have bought the site, so we don't know.
Well, they've taken over most of Manhattan, it seems, at times.
So things change. Now, I mean, before we went on the air, we were talking about the cenotaphs that are on the Via Appia Antica, just outside of Rome, where there are family memorials in beautiful sculpted likenesses of Roman nobles. And to us... 2,000 years later, give or take a few decades, the fact of the Roman Empire is not very interesting to us. That government no longer rules the world. The political intrigues of the late Republic or the early Empire are interesting to read about. But what we enjoy is the artistry of the sculpture. And so what you've created here in this, and also in the Westchester Memorial, but in these works, in the built landscape, I think will be appreciated as sculpture on their own.
I have a question about that, actually, when you finish that thought.
Well, I'm just speculating that you mentioned the Eternal Flame. I suppose about 10 years ago, I was at Arlington, and The whole JFK thing has kind of faded over time for me. You know, this last November 22nd went by, and 2 days later it was like, holy shit, wait, I'm supposed to feel sad on November 22nd. And it went by without me even thinking about it. So that, for those of us who were alive when he was killed, for decades, it was a brooding day.
Right.
Now, it's faded. So I see the eternal flame, and it means something different for me now, because I know there's also an eternal flame under the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, which is there for a different reason, because that's a war memorial.
Right. I think it's how new it is to you. If you know that's what I'm saying. Even if you experienced it or not,
sure.
If the story is new to you, and when I was first told the story and I first saw it, I felt it. I can't say at the same level that someone that experienced it had, but I cried when I saw it. I mean, and I didn't live through that.
Right. Well, and so what I'm putting out is something we could talk about next, which is that. Something that may have been thought of as sad over time accretes different meanings, and so something that was wistful might in fact become joyful.
Right.
So apropos of that, Dan, could you play the next track?
By I see friends shaking and singing, how do you think to myself, what a wonderful world. Someday I wish upon a star, wake up with the clouds are far behind. Me will travel melts like a lemon drops, high above the chimney top, that's where you find me.
Wow, are we back on the air?
I don't know. Sounds so.
I don't think we are.
What were you going to ask, G?
I'll wait.
Thank you.
Curtis.
Oh, hello. I thought I'd drop in. I'm your itinerant host. This is Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, brought to you by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. You can go there with your iMac, or you can have a corporate account, service, technical support, and sales. It's a playground. Even if you're part of the dark conspiracy of the Wintel world, it is really an education, and you deserve to give yourself the treat of dropping into TechServe on West 23rd Street, just west of 6th Avenue, under the bright blue Apple banner. Hard to miss. Our Brit music was, I have to look at my cheat sheet here, the legendary Israel Kamaka Viole with his ukulele. Wow. You know, when he died, he was about 1,000 pounds. But that beautiful voice, he did that in one take at 3 a.m. in 1988. And it's a lot for us to think about. It's when it's right, it just clicks. So what we create is a memorial. And I'm thinking right now at this moment of the fantastic statue of David Farragut in Madison Square. Do you know that sculpture?
Yeah.
Now, that's a war memorial.
Uh-huh.
And yet, you go there, and there are the sad ladies of the sea there with their flowing, watery gowns and this beautiful and inscribed lettering that Augustus St. Gaudens was so good at, because he had trained as a cameo cutter, and that informed his sculptural work for the rest of his career. And this beautifully crafted man looking out, and his flowing a coat, and it's a beautiful, beautiful sculpture of a warrior. And we forget that it's a Civil War monument. We tend here in the North to not want to talk about our Northern War of Aggression, as they call it in the South. And to us, it's just this great tragedy that happened 140 years ago.
Okay, so here's my question, Curtis.
Sure.
What's the difference between a memorial and a monument? I happen to have the definitions here.
Okay, well, a monument could be something as simple as a United States Geological Survey bronze spheroidical a piece of metal in the ground with the latitude, longitude, and elevation of that particular spot.
Historical.
Well, and it could say that we put this down in 1933, and we're saying that this is exactly where it is. Okay, in case you were wondering where you are,
marker.
Before we had
it's
GPS,
marker.
But it's also it's a monument.
Okay. So what's a memorial?
A memorial could be that song, you know. A memorial could be a living work of art. It could be a traveling troupe that memorializes with lyric poetry the valiant deeds of the New York Fire Department. That could be a memorial.
And so what's the difference?
Well, a monument tends to stay put, and a memorial could be
fluid,
movable. Yeah. And, you know, Hemingway's thing about Paris being a moving, movable feast. Well, that's sort of memorializing the 20th century Paris. What do you think, Jessica?
What do
Hemingway
you think?
Didn't have to submit Paris to a competition and be approved by the politicians of New Jersey. I have a question. You know just enough to be dangerous in asking this question, but when you're at an elite architectural firm and you're submitting something to a competition, how does it change when you're thinking about the families of victims having input into a project? I would assume that when you're submitting things for a competition, you have to think not just about what you want to do creatively, but you always have to think about, you know, what you're bidding for and what the people who will receive the design are thinking about. But did it change the conversation, or did the import of this, was there something that just internally was different? Just in terms of the how you actually had to go through getting this.
That's a really interesting question. And I feel like I wasn't part of the, I don't know if I would say elite, but I wasn't part of the, you know, the company at the time that I designed this memorial. And so there's a difference. And I think that, you know, by doing it now and doing it then, it's two different times. Who knows what's, you know, who knows what to say. But for me then, you know, like every artist or wannabe artist, there's a kind of or artists in general, I think that it's the struggle or the understanding of the event, you know, there's like the whole Dada and the whole, you know, there's movements that are in art that are done during times of war and times of strife that actually I think some of the best artwork and artistry comes from. And for me, I was struggling at that time that the New Jersey 9/11 memorial was built, and I think you know, the families, the site, I mean, I would sit at Liberty State Park for hours and days and watch the sunset on Manhattan and think about the event, and it was you know, it's that moves you to seeing a design.
Would that, I mean, what the memorial that Curtis described, I guess if the average person were to think of one, that's at Madison Square Garden, is it fair to say
in Madison Square.
Madison Square, I'm sorry. That they would envision something like that, a famous person, a statue or something.
Well, they might, yeah.
Possibly, but is deviating from that, is that harder to do when you know you're going to have to talk to the families? And I guess I'm assuming that they would want that also, or did you want to ground it in something that was it important for you to make this idea something really accessible, or were you just going with your inspiration, or how did that sort of tension get worked out?
There's a difference between designing a monument or a memorial for one person and designing it for a number of people, and even more so when you don't know what that number is. Like, the, you know, we started with 690 victims from the state of New Jersey. We're up to, you know, 746 people that are lost. And so that number keeps multiplying. So it's the idea of this memorial is not about one person. It's about many people. And so it's the forms and the volumes and the surface of that kind of are talking about something larger than just one person. And I think that, you know, there's a difference between a memorial that's for many and a memorial that's for one. And that's also the difference from...
Well, yeah. And I think that's appropriate. Let's go... Two things came up. One, you said elite. And we'll get back to that. But let's go back a little bit further. Tell us what the definitions that you had.
There. Oh, okay. These are just definitions from the dictionary.
Well, that's fine. That's
this
a good place to start.
This is not something that I started, you know. It's memorial, noun, one. Something such as a monument intended to celebrate or honor the memory of a person or an event.
Memorial as an adjective. 1. Serving as a remembrance of a person or an event. 2. Of, relating to, or being in memory. Monument as a noun. 1. A structure, such as a building or sculpture, erected as a memorial. See how that goes? 2. An inscribed marker placed at a grave, a tombstone. 3. Something for its enduring historic significance or association with a notable past person or thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. You don't, but I was a test for you, Curtis.
It goes around and around, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
looking at
but
this.
But it all gets to memory.
Exactly. I think memorials are kind of more. Memorials are less static, more fluid, and they're they're about honoring memory, and probably something a little bit more emotional than a monument, which could be a historical marker.
Mm-hmm.
Or something.
Another way to do the same idea that you have with your two parallel walls would be you could have an etched piece of transparent material with the image of the pillars of smoke framed at where that site was and look through it from New Jersey. I mean, you could do that also.
I don't know about that.
You could. I mean,
stainless steel, and the finish of the stainless steel was selected for...
Sure. Well, you've got something that's got monumental scale.
Well, you know, it's also about reflection. Not just about, the names are inscribed in a kind of reflective stainless steel. So when you're looking at the names, you're not only seeing the person that you lost, but you're catching a reflection of yourself. So
right.
There's a whole
relationship
there that, you know, we.
But
you can design your own memorial.
I stopped with the Vietnam War. My Vietnam memorial was quite different, but... Perhaps we can.
Where is that?
They didn't get built.
Where was it for?
I wanted to do my memorial on the site where that sort of cubic thing with the glass blocks with the names is over on just off of Water Street in Manhattan.
Okay.
You know? And... I'm too young to have had to go to Vietnam because they stopped the war to accommodate my my college education. Thank you. But had it gone on for another 10 years, life might have been different. But it occurred to me that, well, my impression of the Vietnam conflict was that it was like being lost in a forest with no clear direction and no clear purpose. And so my concept was that there would be a series of tall, slender pipes like a bamboo forest, mm-hmm. but black, and that they should be open, and that they should be tuned like a pan pipe. So down low there'd be a little cut in it, so that as the wind blew from the East River or towards the East River over these pipes of different sizes and heights and diameters, and when you were inside of it, the moving wind would play a wind organ of different moaning sounds while you were inside the memorial. And you could just wander around hearing the sighs of anguish of the people who didn't understand why they were fighting or whom they were fighting. And I thought of it as a visual and acoustic experience. Probably would have just bugged the hell out of somebody who lived down there.
I was
because of
Caroline,
the noise.
Caroline, what she would think of that.
That makes me think of the subway station by Penn Station where you can make noises and you just wave your... It's more performance art in a way of let's hear someone moan and let's hear a bird chirp.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. A memorial for the World Trade Center could be an annual bonfire that sent pillars of smoke up into the sky.
Have you been to Ground Zero?
Yeah. I couldn't go for several years. I mean, in the beginning, I just simply couldn't stand to be anywhere near there because of the smell. You could smell burning.
For years? Really?
No, I couldn't go for years. For months,
while
the pit was still on fire,
yeah,
the stench was beastly. You know, burning electronics and just the whiff of some flesh burning.
Yeah, it
was disgusting.
You know what? I remember the electronics, actually. You know,
It was ghastly. Second thing, elite. One of the party lines here on Burning Down the House is that one of the problems with...
I don't know what elite is. Can we define elite?
Well, I think there's...
I can tell you in the sense in which I'm in it, but...
theoretically, if you looked at my CV... You would think that perhaps I would be an elitist because I have a master's of architecture from Harvard Design School and I went to Cooper Union, which is very selective. But the purpose of a really good design education is to pound out of your head that you actually fucking know anything.
Yeah.
That there are other people and other points of view that must be considered for you to really start... to do your craft as an architect. So if you have a notion of being elite, already you've lost any legitimacy you have.
That said, there are a lot of egos in architecture.
Including you with your host. But I don't want to talk about how great the stuff that I've done is. I'm interested in raising the level of discourse about ideas about what we do and why we do what we do instead of just, what I do.
Speaking of this idea of engaging with the people who are going to be dealing with,
project.
What are your thoughts? I mean, there's a sort of, interesting conversation going on.
There are some situations in which we are directed by our clients who are not necessarily the end users. Do not talk to the end users. That happens so often.
Yeah.
And it puts us in a really difficult position because the end users may not have a champion amongst the client group, you see, mm-hmm. whose agenda might be lowest first cost, not usability.
The reality is that you kind of have to work with the families, but you can't be attached particularly to any one family member. Mm-hmm.
They have their needs.
I personally do, am close with family members, and I value their insight, and they guide me. But one is not all. I mean, there were, 746 people that died from the state of New Jersey, and that, family group is much larger than the group that I speak with.
Well, just thinking about how this process is ideally supposed to happen, was there a conversation or something someone said that made you change something or think about something differently?
Many people have influenced me. I can't. I'm not about to enumerate them on the radio.
Okay. I'm just curious.
I think we've sufficiently flogged the whole notion of a monument being a vehicle for a memory. Well, let's have a little memory music then next. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Of course, from Broadway musical Cats, Memory.
Yeah!
We're burning down the house here on Heritage Radio Network, the 15th of December. Produced and engineered by Dan Brindell. Thank you for your professionalism.
And your hotness.
And your innate hotness, man. That's right. That's right. He is the most hot engineer ever. Looks like a samurai with his ponytail there. Brought to you by TechSurf, number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer on West 23rd Street. Check it out, www.techserve.
They've been around a long time.
Yes, they have. Great. They are, and they just get stronger and better. I mean, there's no place like it. I mean, you know, you can go to the Apple store, but you can go to TechServe and you can really get taken care of, not just being someone talking to the Genius Corp. Not that I have anything against the Apple stores. Thank you. He said, fondling his nano. Love it, love it, love it. Anyway, you know, most of the memorials or monuments to something that's, you know, future-oriented. We used to do time capsules, and we did world's fairs, which were sort of memorials in a kind of way. You know, statements of hope. You remember from architecture school, Corbeau was forever designing memorials to, you know, the future of mankind. If only we would design our buildings that were proportionally correct, we would grow wings and become angels ourselves. But those monuments kind of fall flat. I mean, I'd like to see memorials to aspiration happen a little more, instead of just all kind of you know, sadness or oriented memorials. But I suppose that's just sort of the heritage of most monuments and memorials throughout human history being death oriented. I mean, we don't do memorials for successes all that often. I mean, even to D.C. and seen the World War II memorial.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we won World War II, but you wouldn't guess it from this.
I'd have
weird
no idea what's going on at that memorial.
That static stage set. It's
because you're thinking about the ones that were lost during the time, even though it was successful. You're thinking about those that lost.
Yeah,
let's think about those that succeeded.
I mean, when I was a boy, I really got excited whenever I would see a Korea monument, because it almost always involved an old surplus jet that had been trucked to some place and put on a pillar that was taking off. It was like, yeah, we kick ass. I mean, look at that airplane, you know?
Is that a good sentiment to celebrate and fund and
encourage
in this country, particularly at this point in time? Well, I mean, you see people with, ready to riot over marginal tax rate increases.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
at this point, why not? I mean, I'm kind of excited that things are coming up to a head now and people are
flipping
out, because that's what leads to change. And yes, everyone's in.
You haven't even
yes. Did you see who just won the House of Representatives? That's some wonderful change,
Jesus.
Right?
Oh, Caroline,
are you talking about the tax cuts?
Just wait. Till,
no, I'm saying.
Just wait till we architects start rioting because we can't pay our friggin' rent in 2011.
I'm just saying, insanity leads to change. That's
yeah,
I'm
can
saying.
Only hope. I don't know. I mean, but how? I mean, you know, it would be nice to have a memorial to.
My old apartment that I can't afford anymore.
The audacity of hope seems to have died. How would we memorialize that? I don't know.
New York of the 80s. I'd like a memorial to that.
70s
or 80s.
You mean like an old subway car?
Yeah,
that
we'd just spray paint it.
Dee Dee Ramone staggering through it.
Someone killed us in a tunnel. Yeah.
Well, we have film that has captured that. So to a certain degree, you know, like Escape from New York becomes
a
memorial to
it. That's true.
To an era.
Saturday Night Fever.
Or Saturday Night Fever. Or Saturday Night Live from the 70s.
Why not?
Yeah, these throwaway things become very important.
Yeah, the whole life of John Belushi was sort of like a memorial to the whole, let's do coke and heroin at the same time.
Well, you know what? Now this is.
But that's performance art. See, that's not. That's
here's
not
a little.
The arts.
You know, I feel like when I try to go down into the roots of why we have memorials and monuments and what's the need, I think of Lewis Mumford.
Okay.
Right, and the history of the city.
Right.
And how cities started.
And Mumford wrote a lot about the suburbs, and.
He gave three basic reasons why. Why, you know, people started making cities or started collecting in one group or area. One of those was trade. One of those was agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was death.
Hmm.
So that when people died, they found places to bury them. And so then those became sites where people started to go back. And that's how the city originated. And so then it's always about death then, isn't it? Monuments and memorials are always about, you know, going back to that place where you remember a particular person or thought. And so that's the...
Half the West Village is a memorial for me.
No, but we do love going back to tragedy. We love sticking around and just seeing what happens.
Well, eventually you grow out of that.
Groveling.
And you walk
it.
Past there and say, oh, that was fun. I think it'd be fun to be able to...
Have a happy memorial.
Have happy memorials. I mean, you know, and
that's what McDonald's does.
And before we wrap it up, let's have a little bit of folk music that memorializes a sort of progressive spirit that seems to have died.
All right.
Brothers and sisters, all over this land.
That's right. Suddenly you became politically conscious.
And we should be politically conscious because
nobody gives a shit unless it affects them.
It is all about the love between our brothers and our sisters. But we've kind of like gotten away from the fact that actually all the families of the 9/11 victims were all a collective family of that event. Yes, some of us have lost more, but we all had.
Did you bring up the Bush tax cuts? Or the tax?
Can we get on topic, Caroline?
I'm sorry, but he brought it up. They just passed today that the rich people aren't going to have their tax cuts because nothing's going to get passed if they don't have them.
Well, that's nice.
You know. I'm going to make a memorial to before Caroline had that giant beer. like an 80-ounce can of Modelo.
One way.
And furthermore.
Miss Bailey, we are back on the air.
No, we're not.
Oh, yes, we are. Oh, yes, we are. Yes, yes, yes.
Hello, world.
Caroline's upset that she's not going to get a tax cut.
Yes, and hello, Finland.
So, you know, there are political movements and we don't memorialize them. There are moments of optimism and we don't memorialize them.
Oh, we can talk about the media. I mean, then we can talk about the media and what the media puts in.
Well, do you think? Well, you know, you're
in the news every day.
The media is all now electronic, and some of it is ephemeral. Some of it is a subject of modification.
But I think that people read, you know, people watch and read news more often when it's not about happy stuff, you know?
There's hardly ever any news.
Curtis, I have a question for you, actually. Maybe you've answered this many times, but who do you think is doing the best writing about architecture for a mass audience? Is there anyone?
For a mass audience?
Yeah, journalistic.
Nobody's writing for a mass
New York
audience.
Times, New Yorker.
Even Paul Goldberger.
Paul Goldberger.
He has a piece. He's writing for the Cognoscenti, okay?
Did you read George? I think it was George Packer's piece about. Oh my God. Why am I going blank on this? About the reconstruction of Dresden. Something like that didn't impress you in the New Yorker? He's not really an architecture writer, though.
Well, the problem with writing about architecture is that you have to describe, first of all, you really need to describe what it is you're talking about, unless it's an illustrated piece. Now, Herbert Muschamp used to do a pretty good job of illustrating his pieces, but then what he had to say was just so gonzo that halfway through the piece...
Hey.
What?
Yeah. Were
you a big buddy
of his?
No, I'm just saying, you know.
The word gonzo upset you? what happened?
The word gonzo.
It did?
It upset me.
So no one? The New Yorker writers? New York Times? No one? Okay.
There's a dynamic tension in architecture where people who fancy themselves as academics write pseudo-mystical quasi-English language screeds trying to describe something that's really poetic in their own experience of designing. And what happens is they write such confusing shit that you lose track of where they're going with the thought. And this happens time and time again. I mean, I heard...
it's not just architects, though.
No, well...
You know, there's lots of crazy writers and...
About who write about, you know, art or sculpture or painting or so forth. But it all... Writing about architecture ends up leaving the interested but uninitiated layperson blinking in wonder on a par with the experience of looking at a dissected shark by Damien Hirst in a tank
I would totally agree
of formaldehyde, and you say, well,
I think that's
wait.
A little drastic.
No, I would have to agree
but
with that, actually.
And
I don't know if we... I mean, actually, this probably is not the point you're making at all, but what's an interesting aspect of architecture journalism from my point of view, let me
shamelessly plug myself.
I
am available to replace Nikolai.
Translate. You could be a translator.
At any point. Did you see in the Design Observer the little... opinion that Nikolai Orisov is not good enough for the New York Times? It was a few months ago.
No.
It ran to about 1,500 words, and he did not rebut it, which was interesting. Mm. I don't even think he lives in New York. I don't even think he actually walks around New York and looks at New York. I think he phones it in from L.A., possibly, or Gestadt, or someplace like that. I think... the last time that anybody wrote intelligently about architecture was during the heyday of Ada Louise Huxtable, who could write in real English about real issues. And Brendan Gill wrote pretty well about the built environment, but he's been dead for 25 years.
I think you're bringing up a perfect problem in architecture, and it's not just about writing and architecture, but it also there's also gaps between education and architecture and construction and architecture, and I think that the role of the architect is to wear many hats and kind of have a little information about a lot of disciplines.
Absolutely. Architects should be universalists.
Depending on who you encounter, you may not get what you want. You know, the person might not be able to write like you want them to write. The person might not be able to draw the way you want them to draw. The person might be able to draw, but they don't know how to build anything. So what you're getting is a kind of, you know, idea to construct, and not necessarily the
wherewithal to pull it off.
Yeah,
that's where my work comes in.
This is where
I'm Curtis.
I'm the principal of construction and design analytics, and what I provide is technical assistance to architects who've got a dream but have no idea how to detail it. Or they drew something and it wasn't actually buildable, and it's like, help. If you go to http://cdanalytics.org, you can learn all about the technical services that I provide to other architects and to owners. Shameless plugs are permitted.
That wasn't even trying to be underhanded about your
Caroline,
plug.
Do you have anything you want to plug?
No. Yes, www.retiringbydesign.com.
And Jessica, do you have a personal website or anything like that?
Oh, no, you know, I'm always behind the curtain and I don't mind it.
Okay, well, that's a good... I would much...
Except for Jessica, www.retiringbydesign.com.
I would most of the time rather be influential rather than powerful. I'd rather be Kissinger than Nixon.
I'd like to be powerful and corrupt. Oh, sorry.
Okay. Well, we've gotten
a little bit
off track, but it's
He'd like
fun.
You to be sober.
No,
I'm kidding.
No, Jessica.
Oh,
Jessica,
don't look at me.
If you'd like to participate in a little conversation about learning how to actually do construction, on January 5th, we're going to have a phone conversation with Simeon Warren, the dean of the American College of Building Arts in Charleston, South Carolina. And what they're doing there is to teach design through the vehicle of teaching how to build and how to make various traditional building craft type objects.
Well, that sounds fantastic.
And I think that it's absolutely needed anodyne.
So they don't do popsicle stick models.
They don't do popsicle
Thank
sticks.
Thank God.
You guys got to get into that. You need a whole radio show for this.
Really, our popsicle stick
where's
popsicle
my
stick
Where's
models?
My glue gun, yeah. Right?
Well, how nobody designs anymore, and the accreditation system is messed up.
Imagine someone building a design of a house built out of popsicle sticks. Mm-hmm. Now, how does the door open? What's the wall section like? And, you know,
I mean, at some point that was like considered a serious
It could be
model
fun.
Oh boy.
Well, Dan, I think we've come to the end of our legal
What about Legos?
Here,
are they
which is too bad because we're having such fun here. This has been Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, brought to you by TechServe. Jessica Jamroz, Caroline Bailey
Gregory
from the Daily
Gilderman.
Beast,
Gregory Gilderman.
And I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. We'll speak with you next week with Nick Agnetta, musician, architect, with some holiday music and some thoughts about architecture, looking forward to the year 2011. Thank you for joining us. Talk with you again soon.